Good morning, and welcome to Greater Good. This is your volunteer programmer, Babs Felix, from the Sun Sounds of Arizona studios. The Greater Good Science Center studies the psychology, sociology, and neuroscience of well-being, and teaches skills that foster a thriving, resilient, and compassionate society. And now, some articles from Greater Good. What actually makes you resilient? Our genetics, our skills, our personality, and our environment all come together to influence how resilient we are to stress. By Peter McAvoy, May 15, 2025. In a world with political polarization, war, extreme weather events, and increasing costs of living, we need to be able to cope as individuals and communities. Our capacity to cope with very real stressors in our lives, our resilience, can determine whether we thrive, just survive, or are deprived of a reasonable quality of life. Stress versus resilience. Resilience means having the ability to cope with and rebound from life's challenges and still achieve our goals. Stress isn't something to be avoided. We need to feel some stress to achieve our best. Exposure to manageable levels of stress and adversity develops our coping skills and resilience. But if we feel too much stress, we can flounder or become overwhelmed. The ability to reactivate ourselves when we feel down, fatigued, or disengaged helps to optimize our focus and motivation. Sports people, for example, might listen to high-intensity music just before a competition to increase their energy levels. Conversely, the ability to dampen down emotional intensity can make us feel less stressed or anxious. Exercising, listening to relaxing music, or patting a much-loved pet can prevent high arousal from interfering with completing a task. Effective emotional regulation is crucial for adapting to life's ups and downs and keeping us on a relatively even keel. How does resilience develop? Resilience emerges from interactions between personal and environmental factors. In addition to emotion regulation skills, personal factors that can bolster resilience include academic achievement, developing a range of skills and abilities, such as sport and music, and problem-solving skills. Many of these skills can be fostered in childhood, and if one area of life isn't going well, we can still experience confidence, joy, and meaning in others. People who reflect on traumatic experience and develop new positive meanings about themselves, such as getting through it means I'm strong, and life, a greater appreciation, can also have higher levels of resilience. Genetic factors and temperament also play a role. Some of us are born with nervous systems that respond with more anxiety than others in novel, uncertain, or potentially threatening situations. And some of us are more likely to avoid rather than approach these situations. These traits tend to be associated with lower levels of resilience, but we can all learn skills to build our resilience. Environmental factors that promote resilience include a nurturing home environment, supportive family and peer relationships, cultural identity, belonging, and rituals, modeling from others, overcoming hardship, community cohesion, government policies that provide social safety nets, strong education, anti-discrimination, and inclusion, and investment in facilities, spaces, services, and networks that provide support and support the quality of life and well-being of communities. Can resilience be taught? Many factors associated with resilience are modifiable, so it stands to reason that interventions that aim to bolster them should be helpful. There is evidence that interventions that promote optimism, flexibility, active coping, and social support seeking can have small yet meaningful positive effects on resilience and emotional well-being in children and adults. However, school-based programs give us reason to be cautious. A trial across 84 schools in the United Kingdom evaluated the effectiveness of school-based mindfulness programs. More than 3,500 students aged between 11 and 13 years received 10 lessons of mindfulness, and a similar number did not. There was no evidence that mindfulness had any benefit on risk for depression, social, emotional, and behavioral functioning, or well-being after 1 year. Teaching school children mindfulness at scale did not appear to bolster resilience. In fact, there was some evidence that it did harm, and it was most harmful for students at the highest risk of depression. The intervention was not deemed to be effective or cost-effective and was not recommended by the authors. In another recent trial, researchers found an emotion regulation intervention with year 8 and 9 school children was unhelpful and even harmful, although children who engaged in more home practice tended to do better. These interventions may have failed for a number of reasons. The content may not have delivered in a way that was sufficiently engaging, comprehensive, age-appropriate, frequent, individually tailored, or relevant to the school context. Teachers may also not be sufficiently trained in delivering these interventions for them to be effective. And students didn't co-design the interventions. Regardless of the reasons, these findings suggest that we need to be cautious when delivering universal interventions to all children. It may be more helpful to wait until there are early signs of excessive stress and intervene in an individualized way. What does this mean for resilience building? Parents and schools have a role in providing children with a sense of security that gives them confidence to explore their environments and make mistakes in age-appropriate ways, and providing support when needed. Parents and teachers can encourage children to try to solve problems themselves before getting involved. Problem-solving attempts should be celebrated even more than success. Schools need to allocate their scarce resources to children most in need of practical and emotional support in non-stigmatizing ways rather than universal approaches. Most children will develop resilience without intervention programs. To promote resilience, schools can foster positive peer relationships, cultural identity, and involvement in creative, sporting, and academic pursuits. They can also highlight others' recovery and resilience stories to demonstrate how growth can occur from adversity. More broadly in the community, people can work on developing their own emotion regulation skills to bolster their confidence in their ability to manage adversity. Think about how you can approach challenges in constructive ways, actively problem solve rather than avoid challenges, genuinely accept failure as part of being human, establish healthy boundaries, align your behavior with your values, receive social and professional support when needed. This will help you navigate the ebbs and flows of life in ways that support recovery and growth. About the author. Peter McAvoy, PhD, is a professor of clinical psychology at Curtin University. You are listening to Greater Good Magazine, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. Embracing the uncertainty of being a mom. Parenting is full of questions, and people online purport to have all the answers for raising perfect kids. The reality is much more complicated. By Elizabeth Weingarten, May 9th, 2025. It was around 5 a.m. when my husband opened the creaky door to the guest room, cradling our five-month-old. For a few weeks, they'd both been sleeping in the same room, and I'd been stationed across the hall. We hoped our son would wake less frequently if he didn't smell me and my milk. Not so much. This was the sixth or maybe seventh time he'd been up that night. I had lost track. It felt like I had just put him back down and soothed myself back to sleep. My body depleted and aching, refused to move. As my husband set our son down beside me, I burst into tears. By my rough calculation, I'd slept about 4 hours that night, one of many such nights that week. I had to start work soon. In those days, newly back from maternity leave, I could barely string a sentence together. "I can't do this anymore," I sobbed into the pillow. Our son gurgled and shrieked, smiling at me and pulling my hair. The emotional dissonance made me cry even harder. Here was my beautiful baby, excited to be alive and spending time with his mom. And here was his mom, who was losing her shit. For weeks, the solution to my problem seemed clear. I needed the answer to one essential question. How in the hell do I get my son to sleep through the night? If I could just get the answer to that question, everything would be okay. In that moment, I was starting to realize the solution was more complicated and that I had been looking for answers from the wrong people and in the wrong places. Can someone just tell me what to do? For months, I'd been desperate for the answers about sleep. It wasn't that I hadn't been searching for them. The problem was the answers I found weren't working. Did I just need to wait out this period until things got better? Or was it simply that I hadn't yet found the video, social media post, online course, or blog that contained the magic solution? It was tempting to think that if I just clicked on one more influencer post purporting to contain the 5 key secrets to baby sleep, or another one promising that if I do these 3 things, my baby will sleep 12 hours a night, or yet another calling me out for perpetuating these 4 terrible habits that are preventing my baby from sleeping, then finally I'd have the answer. Not only were these one-size-fits-all, often unscientific insights not working for our family, they were making me feel even worse. And yet, glassy-eyed and anxious, I found myself continuing to scroll as I daydreamed about absconding to a dark, cool hotel room for the night of sleep. Now might be the time to mention to you that I had also written a book called How to Fall in Love with Questions, all about how to have a different and better relationship to uncertainty. Part of it focuses on how certain mom influencers exploit followers during the highly uncertain and vulnerable period of becoming a mom. In the book, I call these guru influencer types the charlatans of certainty and define them as people who manipulate others into believing that the charlatans have all the answers to their sometimes unanswerable questions. I was falling into the same influencer content trap that I'd written about. The more fast, easy answers I consumed, the worse I felt, and the further away I felt from having clarity about how to navigate the ever-present uncertainty of motherhood. How did I get there? How could I get out? The drive for certainty. Sure, part of the problem was the charlatans of certainty and the way social media platform algorithms were designed to keep us coming back for more glittering content. But there were also larger cultural forces at play creating demand for it. Though uncertainty is a feature of life, the transition into motherhood can be particularly unsettling because of cultural myths that fashion mothers as magical creatures who know all of the answers. Before welcoming a child, we think we know who a mother is, someone who delights in being self-sacrificial, who always knows the right answer, who comforts and nourishes. Sarah Peterson, author of Mom Influenced, a book about the history and impact of social media mom influencers, told me in an interview for my book. Once we undergo that transition, it makes sense that we imagine we're going to have a Cinderella moment where we go from being a human person full of doubts to being an otherworldly being, so much of our culture tells us that mothers are. When Peterson herself became a mom, she thought motherhood would be fulfilling in all ways that would eradicate inner self-doubt and insecurities, she recalls. It did not do those things. If anything, it exacerbated them. As she started to question who she was and who she wanted to be, the mom influencers stepped in to provide answers, not only to what motherhood might look like via photos of clean, joyful children, perfectly styled, energetic moms, and serene, clean countertops and unstained upholstery, but also to what mothers did and fundamentally what they bought. I found myself almost perversely drawn to these accounts, Peterson told me. I was constantly searching for different representations of motherhood I might inhabit to make my experience feel better. I was looking for blueprints for how to be. It was a search that felt shameful because of another pervasive centuries-old myth, that new mothers instinctually, intuitively know how to care for their new babies, that the encyclopedic knowledge of care is uploaded to their brains as a parting gift when the baby is born. In her book, Mother Brain, journalist Chelsea Conaboy uses contemporary neuroscience and historical research to demonstrate that the roots of maternal instinct lie in misogynistic cultural attitudes, not biology. The parental brain does change, but that change takes time and is driven as much by experience, by exposure to the powerful stimuli babies provide, as the hormonal shifts of pregnancy and childbirth, she writes. The notion that selflessness and tenderness babies require is uniquely ingrained in the biology of women, ready to go at the flip of a switch, is a relatively modern and pernicious one, she writes. The cause and cost of trust. With all of the pressure mothers put on ourselves to have the answers, it's no wonder that we go searching for them from sometimes dubious sources on social media. But that search has consequences for our health and quite possibly for our kids' health. Sierra Kirkpatrick, an assistant professor of advertising and public relations at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, studies how media messages influence individuals' health outcomes, which stemmed in part from seeing the pervasive influence of social media on her decisions as a mother. In a 2022 study, she exposed 464 new mothers with a child 3 years old or younger to 20 Instagram posts from what she labeled mommy influencers and everyday mothers. Half of the posts presented idealized depictions of motherhood with glossy made-up mothers, grinning children, and spotless homes. The other half were more realistic portrayals. The mothers exposed to the idealized posts, whether they were created by mommy influencers or everyday mothers, experienced increased anxiety and envy. This urge and tendency to trust social media moms is understandable, Jessica Gross told me. Gross is a New York Times opinion writer and author of Screaming on the Inside. For one thing, the sleep deprivation alone is enough to warp anyone's ability to make decisions and distinguish fact from fiction. In actual cults, they don't let you sleep, so you'll become more suggestible, Gross pointed out. Another factor is also social isolation, which may be a challenge for new mothers who live far from family or friends, or who don't have people in their lives whom they trust for parenting advice. Motherhood, Kirkpatrick told me, can be very isolating at times, even if you do live near family and community. you're likely experiencing a major change to your routine and social life. For instance, you might not be going out with friends and coworkers like you used to, and you might not be going to work like you used to. Just being at home and alone with a child all day can be isolating in itself, just because of the changes to your routine. You can feel really alone in your emotional state and the struggles you're going through. Breaking free of the certainty trap. Alone in my emotional state was exactly how I felt as I sobbed in bed at 5 a.m. And it was how I'd been feeling even on some days when I did miraculously get more sleep. That was because sleep was only part of my struggle. The sleep question laid bare all sorts of other questions about co-parenting, my identity as a mother, how my own struggles with anxiety could impact my kid. My husband and I had been arguing more frequently as we butted heads on sleep training, screen time, and dividing up care. It was about how anxious and worried I felt hearing other moms talk about their great sleepers and realizing that this was just the beginning of many years of trying to resist such comparisons. These questions were uncomfortable and not answerable on a short timeline or with the content I would find on social media. What then to do about these kinds of questions, the ones that didn't have fast, easy answers? It wasn't until I went on a walk with a new mom I'd met in my town that I remembered a lesson I'd learned from writing my book. Sometimes what we're seeking when we search for answers isn't just the answer to a single question. We're also motivated by the drive for connection, belonging, community, and meaning. In other words, sometimes we want answers, and sometimes we simply want to feel less alone in the uncertainty we're facing. This woman and I were both part of a mother's club, one where many of the moms had been sharing their stories of their babies sleeping through the night. She and I both had babies who could barely make it 2 hours without waking up. As other moms decried the four-month sleep regression, we laughed about the fact that our babies never slept well, so there wasn't much to regress to. "It's like we have the same baby," she said, laughing, as we wound our way through Northern California redwoods, infants strapped to our chest. But for now, it was enough to know that we were facing the same messy questions, embedded in the uncertainty of real life rather than the artificial certain world of social media. We didn't know the answers, but perhaps eventually we would uncover them together. You've been listening to Greater Good Magazine, coming to you from Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your programmer, Babs Felix, thanking you so much for listening today, and I hope that you have a great rest of your day.